Greetings, everyone there in webinar land. Thank you for being with me today for webinar number 10 out of 11. So you can see there's a sort of a list of the titles of all 11 webinars, and we're now down to the number 10 one, Cracking Target Whale Accounts. Now, in the green box, you'll notice that all parties are welcome to, first of all, email me, bruce@merrifield.com, if you want the slides for this particular show, number 10. If you can't wait and you want, you know, all the slides for all the shows, we have sort of a master deck of all that stuff. You know, we're happy to send them to existing Waypoint clients. Or if you're a special friend of our Canadian partners, Stefan David and Ken France, or Randy McLean here in the States, talk with them and they'll send you the deck, the whole deck, if you'd like. They're also available on request to trade associations, buying groups, you know, large distribution chains that may want to have a customized, you know, webinar session, sort of cherry picking some of these slides. The answer is yes. Just send me, inquire, and we'll start a dialogue to my email address. So, moving on, what are the uses for this particular video or webinar thing? I think most distributors understand that, you know, they're big accounts and they're important, you don't want to lose them, and there are other accounts we really would like to do well, and we try to put better sales guys on better accounts, and you know, we're always trying to sort of crack, get new big target whale accounts. This is really about what are some tools and concepts to take whatever we're doing and crystallize it and take it to the next level. So some assumptions about next level selling. I mean, we should be thankful for our core profit whales. I mean, you know, it's not unusual to find that a distributor could have 1,000 accounts over several locations. And I mean, 10 of them are the whole story. It's like, oh my gosh, I don't know how we lucked into these guys and why they want to keep buying from us, but let's not rock the boat. This is fantastic. Don't lose them. Of course, our competitors have theirs too. And to go steal one of those, you know, from the competitor, that's tough because there's loyalties there and there's a lot of equity in the relationship, and switching costs are, you know, actually, you know, kind of a hassle and bigger than most people want to believe. And then a variation would be, oh, we have some accounts that are very large in sales and margin dollars, but their picks and orders are so humongous that the cost to serve dollars exceeds the margin dollars, and we're losing a lot of money. I mean, I've seen accounts for losing $50,000 to $100,000 a year on $2.5 million in volume, and they just love the sales and they love the margin dollars. Just can't get their head around the fact that they're just eating us alive as far as activity costs. So to go out and take any old accounts, core guys, target accounts, big losers to the next level is kind of what we're thinking about today, most narrowly on cracking, stealing accounts. Now, we can go out to big potential accounts and we can, you know, schmooze them and call on a regular basis and be patient and hope somehow that the incumbent, you know, fumbles the ball or retires or dies or some key buyer finally croaks, you know, and maybe there's a chance to get some business. And or we could go out and say, well, hey, you know, how about five off? Oh, well, let me think about it. That's just code for I'm going to give a last look to the incumbent. You know, and if they, you know, knock off the price 1 or 2 points, they're still going to keep it. They don't have to match the price because switching costs and so forth. Maybe sometimes we're like, okay, here, you know, I've decided it's yours. Well, that means the incumbent said, you know, I wasn't making any money before, and now I'm really going to lose a lot of money. I mean, I'm going to basically have to let this go. And in some cases, you know, you try to do this kind of routine, the incumbent will go right over your biggest account and say, hey, how about 10 off? And, I mean, you know, they'll start basically a retaliation price war. You know, you want to come out and, you know, chisel my accounts, I'm gonna retaliate. So one of the ways to do next level selling is to get out of the frame of product for price and say, look, we have all we have or could get all the stuff you need and buy. The question would be, how do we get it to and through you at the lowest total procurement cost with the most uptime productivity so you can take care of your customers better and they'll stay with you and you can grow faster, more profitable? I mean, that would be a very holistic way of looking at how you use stuff flowing through your place. But to do that, we're asking the customer, in a sense, you know, step back and think about how they replenish or buy stuff in a different way, one. Two, they'd have to change some of their internal systems, et cetera. And it's not going to happen unless you have somebody on the buy side who says, wow, that's a great idea. I get it. And I want to make it happen here. You have to have, in a sense, an internal at the customer champion who gets it and wants to make it happen. Otherwise, you know, they're just going to, you know, inertia habits are going to sort of prevail. And the key point here is reps calling on buyers in silos, and big corporations have very much more specialization of labor and organizational charts, and they're guys, they're all their little silos, and they all have their little world, and they have their little metrics, and they want to all optimize their world, their silo, and their metrics, even if it's dysfunctional for the overall system economics. So calling on a buyer in a silo, those two people can't step back, look at the big picture, and have the power to, in a sense, change the inter-business processes that are going on. Maybe some of the friction. In other words, you say, look, here are some, you know, specific SKUs you're buying a specific department that are crazy. You know, we can make this little tweak, and then that would save both of us money. How about doing that? I mean, you might be able to do that. So, but having said all that, if our total team brain trust focuses on a few, most likely, because we've done run all of our biggest, best accounts through a criteria thing to sort of come up with, you know, the, you know, basis, what we know, the odds of making something happen different, better with account, this seems to be the most likely one. Let's hyper focus on that particular customer. And then if you're prepared to go out and be dynamically flexible, in theory, starting like a 3PL company with open book, you know, here's our stuff, landed cost, you know, what do you want, how do you want it, and all of our services or fees, and let's co-create, you know, something that's totally tuned and customized to you, your context, your reality, your values, and so forth. Now, that would be customer centricity as opposed to, no, we have a standard service model, and this is the way we do it, and, you know, our rep is going to call on you a regular basis, and they'll quote you some prices, and that's just the way it's going to be, not very customer-centric. So, these are two sort of business models that are sort of like at maps. And it's like, well, where, you know, you're the big mall. Where are you in the mall? Where are you in the map type of thing? And first of all, we're talking about on the pyramid of accounts on the right-hand side, we can see that the way I've organized this is sort of strata. In other words, there's zillions of little customers who would love wholesale list prices and whole services. Oh, you need me trade credit? You're going to deliver to my place? That's awesome. Here's a retail-sized order. And I don't care what the margin percent is. The problem is the margin dollars in the order is not enough to cover the cost to serve. So this is a retail business, and, you know, distributors have no business being in here. They do collect them, though. The next strata up is what I call wholesale, where, you know, this is Fastenal or W.W. Granger store. It's a location on a four-lane commercial highway. You can see the little sign. You can pull in a few parking spaces. But you walk in and you help yourself to the stuff. The margins run 50 to 75% in some cases. You pay cash or credit card, and you kind of, you know, you figure it out on your own. As opposed to trying to take care of these size orders where your warehouse people pick it, pack it, and you ship it, again, you're going to be upside down. The cost to serve dollars are going to be greater than the margin dollars, particularly if you're selling at wholesale list price. You could get some accounts that are bigger. They can't afford, they can't support the cost of face-to-face outside sales costs, but telemarketing, email, you know, kind of stuff, come to our website. You know, you could turn that, you could have a business model that would make money on that. And then basically you got A accounts where the margin dollars are great enough annually and the average margin dollar per transaction is high enough that you can actually have a rep call on the account and it could still be net profitable. But we're talking now about the very top 1%. And these little black lines mean that at the low end, you basically raise prices and cut back terms, so you're not giving them much. Here you can sort of say, all right, we're going to give you strict minimum orders, freight's unbundled, and we'll give you trade credit, but trade credit from hell. You know, if there's any problem, you're guilty till proven innocent. And so basically what we're doing is we're putting over here more and more services or service value bundled into what we're offering. But up here, it flutes way out. And typically, when we go to very biggest, best accounts, reps will call on them more often. We'll give them contract prices. Hopefully, some of our employees know that these are bigger, better, more customers, and they do extra efforts for them, except heroic acts and hustle a little bit more. We're really going after the top 1%, 2%, 3% of the customers who are the most open-minded, progressive, and innovative. If they have a track record of partnering with vendors and they're partnering with their employees, partnering with stakeholders, really, in a general, in a win-win basis, and they have a track record of doing new things, then they're going to be more receptive to, hey, let's change the way we sell for a win-win. So that's where we're going to go. We're going to go up here just at the, you know, the most selective guys, and we're going to be looking at a lot of extra services, whether they be bundled or unbundled for fees. You know, it depends. Now, basically, underlying replenishment systems that we're going to sell holistically is the concept of total procurement cost. So you have buying costs, and once the stuff is delivered, if you don't consume it right there in the doorstep instantly, then you would have storage costs and storage maintenance kinds of costs. So this is a buyer in their silo, and they're going, hey, what's your price? But to get a good price, I got to call 2, 3, 4, 5 guys or fax 15 people or whatever. So there's shopping time. And then if I buy from 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people, I'm going to have that many more invoices and paperwork to do. The people with the lowest price have the crummiest service, so the right stuff does not get to the right place. And now I got downtime, and I'm expediting, saying, where is it? I'm in a bit of the hothouse. I don't like that. Are there any screw-ups? We get shipped short, long, wrong, you name it. I got to take care of that. And then again, when it gets here, you know, we have to have internal handling to get the paperwork back to my office to do the three-way paper match to sort of, you know, send this over to payables and get the bill paid, you know, on some sort of timely basis. And then we have storage costs. Now, over here, if we have the best one-stop shop in-stock fill rates for a target customer niche, better than anybody else, call us first, because you just have to make one phone call and you get everything you want. You don't, and this consolidates shopping time, paperwork time. If we have zero errors and 100% on time delivery, there are no mistakes and no expediting, and so you have more uptime as a happy byproduct. If you have unusual problems and we do heroic actions where there is a screw up and we do it, take care of that faster and better than anybody else, that's going to minimize this expense. And then because we've got statistical data on how you buy, we can come out right away and offer tweaks, which basically creates positive trade-offs here. Sometimes we'll actually load you up with a little bit more inventory, but as a result of it, your productivity, your paperwork costs drop. In other words, you don't have emergency, oh, I'm out of this quick, ship me $5 right away, and I'll have $100 of the paperwork, you know, to fool around with. So we want to look at our service features, but say, beneficially, how do they reduce some or all of these elements over here? Now, this model of total procurement cost is a buyer silo model. Not that buyers necessarily get that. I mean, you know, to a certain degree, great businesses teach customers how to be better buyers and create win-win juice for both sides of the fence. Expediting typically is blind to the downstream. Oh, well, what was the cost of your downtime in the plant because you didn't have what you needed when you needed? Or the flip side of, if people were doing what they needed to do when, on an uptime basis and an on-time basis, how did that help satisfy your customers and keep your customers happy coming back to you? The retention economics, helping you grow faster, more profitably as a whole business type of thing. And again, they don't sort of see the internal positive trade-offs, like, yes, how about if we loaded you up with more inventory, but at the same time reduced, you know, emergency orders, downtime, all those other things, and so it was a positive trade-off. So when we look at the next slide, you know, it's using the parable, the story of the six blind men, each groping a different part of the elephant and having a bitter argument about what the beast looks like. Because if they took their glasses off and looked at the whole thing, they go, oh my gosh. So you can have somebody from, you know, accounting finance department say, hey, let's beat up all the vendors for lower prices. Just demand 5 off from everybody, baby. That's the way to build our bottom line and screw them. It's a win-lose proposition, but times are tough. Let's do it. Well, that's one lens. But, you know, you're sort of saying, but if I do that, then why would the suppliers give me heroic service? Maybe they're going to cut back. Maybe they stop selling us altogether. And maybe the guys with the lowest price are going to give us lousy service, and the cost of the lousy service far exceeds the price saving. They don't care. They're not looking at the whole beast and the inherent trade-offs. They're not trying to optimize the whole thing. Somebody else says, I read a book on just-in-time manufacturing. We need just-in-time for MRO stuff, including things like Q-tips and spices in our kitchen. And, you know, it's like, really? You know, we're stocked out all the time, and it's an emergency order and so forth. But again, that's just one narrow lens, and it does not work for small, popular little stuff. You know, paper clips in your desk, do you know how many weeks supply do you have? Maybe, you know, we need just-in-time delivery for your paper clips. The activity costs for replenishing, no dollars, and the cost of downtime of not having the paper clip when you need it far exceed this concept of just-in-time. Just-in-time works great for big, bulky, expensive, you know, components that are going into whatever you're making, but not necessarily for small, geeky little MRO stuff. We already talked about the 11 elements of total procurement cost. Then there's a guy saying, wait a minute, downtime is much bigger, more expensive, whatever, than these guys could possibly ever imagine. You know, this is crazy. And then somebody's saying, yeah, but wait a minute, we need uptime and do it right the first time to get it to the customers to have better customer retention, satisfaction, whatever. So, you know, we're going to basically go out and say, let's look at the big picture and how do we get stuff to and through you so that all these things are optimized in the most effective way for you. Now, to do that, we're going to have to be inventors, because every customer is going to be, you know, contextually, peculiarly different. You know, the interesting news is, you know, all humans have 99.5% common DNA, but it's the last 0.5% that gives you, you know, makes a pharmaceutical work or not work as far as side effects or, you know, benefits or whatever. I mean, the, you know, the small stuff can really matter. And so as we go through a big account, they're going to say, well, yeah, we want this. Well, okay, we'll figure it out. We'll invent it. It, you know, this kind of problem has happened before. We'll steal ideas from other channels or whatever, and we'll make it work. So rather than being, you know, just a product pusher, hey, we want to sell more stuff and get rebates from vendors, in addition, and also, we have to put on sort of a three-party logistics kind of hat. Say, you know what? We know all of our little cost-to-serve activities, and what do you want? How do you want them? And basically, we could start with an open book, landed cost, and add everything. And one element is actually cost of capital. That's also a fancy word for your operating profit. So you do need an operating profit because all the assets in your business, et cetera, are not for free. When I say four-party logistics, that means you're actually going to factories and or other allies to sort of put together a total solution, including maybe special prices that flow through to the target customer. So we've got to even think more expansive than just within our four walls. So I put some cases here where, for example, for McDonald's, they've done business with the same distributors uninterrupted for 60 since 1956 and counting. And basically, it's open book and everything's, you know, services for fees and all that sort of stuff. And it's, and if the manufacturers offer, you know, special prices or terms or packaging or whatever, that flows through the distributor to McDonald's. McDonald's can audit the distributor's book. The manufacturers can audit it. And they're happy to give this 3PL company their operating profit, because otherwise they could not make this 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 equal 15 work. A second case study would be where where'd my little mouse go here? Number two there, where and this goes back to net profit analytics play number two, which I think was in webinar number four, where a CEO went into his biggest, most net profitable company, walked through, chatted people up, just looked for pain, friction, stupid problems, delays, et cetera, wound up in the vice president of supply chain's office and said, by the way, I'm out there talking to your guy in the factory plant manager, and he has a huge space taken up by all his packaging material, skids and skids and skids of, you know, basically styrofoam kinds of packaging things. And he needs that space for more manufacturing. And I said, well, you know what? You can buy that stuff. pay your vendor, but have them ship it to me. And I'll act like a 3PL. I charge you a fee to receive it, store it, pick it, and deliver it to you. But our trucks are over here every day on a just-in-time delivery system for OEM ingredients that you're using from us. So I can deliver this on a timely basis and free up 99% of your space there. And then, you know, I don't necessarily have to give them a sweetheart deal. I mean, no 3PL is going to, you know, have a truck going there every day anyway type of thing. So he was able to, you know, basically quote a win-win and create net profit from his new 3PL division that was doing basically bulk packaging. And then he also noticed that there was some processing going on saying, you can outsource that to us. We have the capabilities in-house to process and kit and whatever and do that. And actually, because we do it for many customers, we can do it at a larger scale, more efficiently than you. It's an arbitrage. And besides, your plant manager said he's running overtime and he doesn't want to hire more people and the unions, blah, 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 blah. So anyway, but the CEO, it was his business. He had the power to think out of the box and make commitments and things that no sales rep calling on a buyer in a silo would have even seen or even had the ability to sort of perceive or, you know, or the flexibility to say, we can do it without running to his boss and checking to see if they could do it type of thing. Also, as you go through, you'll see on-site services. Now, there's a whole range of on-site services here from trivial. We'll come in and create a California closet replenishment system. We'll put barcodes, speed numbers, whatever. So it's just easy to visually say, oh, I'm getting low on this, and what else do I need to build an average order size and make it easy to enter it into our website, as opposed to, oh, you want me to come out here and monitor on a regular basis. Next step would be, oh, you want me to have full-time people out here running company stores and having, you know, vending machines. I mean, so there's a continuum of how much integration, you know, and involvement you'd have within their place. And that's, you know, that depends, and you'll figure it out on a case-by-case basis. Second dot point here, provide on-site services along the continuum. I've sort of been through that. How are you going to go about doing this? If you're open-minded and going on a tour and you're looking for any and all pain, you're trying to remove restrictions, you know, and looking for ways to create. You guys are thinking, now, how can we do something and it would reduce costs for both us and them? And then how am I going to find little fans that love this and say, this is great. Well, could we put that in writing so that when the next buyer comes in from the outside and wants to throw this whole thing out, we have all these little testimonials from all over the place saying, no, there's a lot more value, hidden value and switching costs than you can possibly imagine. Let's not switch. So what would you use for target account criteria? And then once you have a bunch of ideas, how would you, if you had 100 points, how would you allocate the points? How would you weight them? And then come up with an overall ranking, and then who's number one? And you might go out there and start to sort of noodle away on working, cracking that account. But based on information, you may say, oh, learning what we know now, we're going to bump this guy down to number four and go to work on the new number one. So, you know, constantly ranking and re-ranking and learning is going to be the key to focusing on the five biggest, best target likely accounts that you're going to have at any given profit center. So here's some particular criteria. Obviously, if they have big potential, and even better, if they're growing. Statistically, about 3% of all businesses in mature industries are perpetual innovators. That's it. There are lots of people that make, you know, fine tunings. They're always fine tuning the past, and, you know, and whatever the herd is doing, and the herd is new. Okay, we'll do that too. They're mimickers and so forth. But people that are going where no one else has gone before and trying new stuff, that, you know, that's a small percent of the population that wants to and can do that. So, you can basically say, what for the last 5 years, what's the incident of these people doing kind of cool new stuff and they're growing faster because of it? You know, you're going to get down to the 3%. Now, there are, you know, in this day of private equity rolling up everything, there are consolidators. So they're big and they're getting bigger by acquisition. So in theory, if you could marry or partner them, they would grow you. But that does not mean that these people have a track record of creating win-win evergreen relationships. They may actually be zero sum, let's get bigger and pound on our vendors even more so we can win and they can lose. So you'd have to be a little bit more careful there. Besides being big and or growing and innovating, do they seem to have a pattern of ordering on a larger gross margin dollar per transaction basis as opposed to having a blizzard of small picks and small orders on a contractual basis? Now, the fact that a customer orders less frequently in larger quantities, that's a symptom. What are the underlying root causes for why that is? You know, and if you have, you know, Waypoint Analytics, for example, you can do a deep dive and you can start to see what they're buying, where they're buying, how they're buying. And you start to say, oh, you know, what's going on here? Conversely, you can find customers that are killing you with small picks and or small orders. Some of them can be corrected on a win-win basis. Other ones, you're saying, you know what, we're just being abused. They're buying the cream one way, and they want to give us all the little activity. And since we're not sensitive to cost to serve, we just think the margin dollars and margin percent are great, not realizing the cost to serve is even much greater. And it's not fixable. Certainly, you can make a case and try to work with them, but that failing, you may have to dictate new terms, and they may go have to paralyze some other competitor. They fit your best niche. Most distributors don't think in terms of customer niches and the peculiar metrics for those niches and tune those metrics to actually have the best service excellence for a given niche and therefore to be the most partnerable. I mean, if somebody wants to get married, they're going to want to marry the best guaranteed perfect service kind of player. So obviously, if you've got big strengths, measurably so, in a target niche, and other big best customers in that niche, you've got an immediate advantage over the competition as far as just basic underlying value prop. If you got a foot in the door, that's easier to go get big as opposed to they've never heard of you before. So, you know, obviously this is a big factor. Access to open-minded buying influences versus stealth moves. I mean, it took me, I don't know, 6-9 months to get nibbles out of a buyer who'd been in his spot for 27 years, and he was going to die in that spot, and he had been getting kickbacks from his three best vendors for the last 27 years. I mean, I basically had to do bottom-up stealth stuff and top-down things to sort of crack that account significantly. As opposed to, hey, you know, you just go in there and say, hey, you know, here's what's going on. I mean, here's what we could do. And what do you think? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And here's how you could be a hero and everybody could win. They go, God, that's a great idea. Do they have a track record of trust? I'm not going to mention a name, but we saved a big order for a huge potential account. And the buyer said, who's new, said, why aren't you up here with this annual contract? We found out that they put this thing out to bid and basically, you know, then loaded on all kinds of extra stuff. You could make money selling them. And so every year they had a new annual contract with a new guy who then regretted getting it because they found out they were losing their rear end and basically had to cut back on the service quality. So what's their track record of partnering with vendors for objective, strategic, smart reasons, as opposed to, oh, we've been doing the same business forever because we get kickbacks and, you know, whatever. If there is a new VP of supply chain or a new CEO with sort of a, we need to change things around here, you know, that's an opportunity. I'm not saying it's General Motors in 1990 bringing in Mr. Lopez as the head of all purchasing, who immediately asks for 5 off or 15 off from all of his vendors. Chop, chop, no tears, we're partners. So, new guy, new imperative, screw all the vendors, as opposed to, wait a minute, find the best guy, marry him, and continue to synergize with them over time. So at any rate, you know, you can come up with others if you want to, but brainstorm, start to weight them, see if you can agree on that, whatever, and come up with some working ranking report. Once you've done that, I've got 5 concepts, account cracking concepts I want, a 9-step sort of, you know, system selling process, strategic supply questions. Do we have, we're at a dome cell. Do we have an entrepreneur project manager on the account making it all happen? Is this the local rep that happens to have it or not? And then the concept called lucky portholes. So let's look at these things. On team selling process, this is chronologically, theoretically, the steps that you would go through. You know, we're going to do our criteria list. Do we have a little foothold? We're going to go in and say, hey, would you be considered, you know, interested in buying in a whole different, better, fantastic way and building your bottom line and growing customer satisfaction and lowering elements of TPC and whatever? Now, we could go in and do a tune-up. And with net profit analytics, you can find friction at the SKU reorder kind of level and just do quick tune-ups, which is great. And that actually increases number two and number one, sort of gives you the increases the odds you could actually do a more thorough analysis, talk about re-engineering, if you will, the entire process. So anyway, we do our deep analysis. We come back and say, here's the pitch. Up front, we say, look, we only want to do this if we have a champion and you have a champion. They're fixed at the, you know, hitched at the hip, and they have the same new innovation metrics to measure. Because when we install this, we're not going to get all the intended benefits right away. We have to measure them and improve them and discipline them, and then we have to continue to adapt the system because the world changes and your replenishment needs change and so forth. And this will allow us to maintain and expand the relationship. But we also, as we come up with, you know, ways to save you money, whatever, want to sort of, you know, commemorate this with, you know, memos and so forth, because ultimately we would like to go to other accounts and say, hey, we've put in this holistic system, which is invisible to people in silos. And so the best way to sell something that you can't see is testimonials. So we would hope that you'd be so happy. You'd say, yeah, you need to marry these guys like we did because it's awesome. But more importantly, what's going to happen is there's going to be turnover at key spots, buying influences within your, you know, your target account. And if somebody comes from the outside, they're going to say, I can be an instant hero by just shopping this everywhere, getting somebody to say, I'll do whatever they're doing, however they're doing it, and I'll give you five off. And you know, if they switch, it's going to be a disaster. So we need to have, you know, ammunition to say, oh, no, you wouldn't want to do that because you're not seeing the value that's here and the cost, the switching costs. But notice over here, if you thought about what it takes to do these things, all these things, these are different skills and time that has to be committed. This is not a rep on a commission plan making regular calls on a regular basis. They just cannot be done with that kind of a selling model. Strategic supplier questions. You may say, okay, this is a really good account, but you want to basically walk in there, you know, right up front and say, look, you know, just step back, big picture. When you look at all the category spend you have for what in theory we could sell, the channel we're from and whatever, you know, just be honest. Who's your number one, two, three vendor from just a percent? And then the second question is, you know, What for what reason is number one and two, and how long has that been? And if there's been any shifts, yeah, number two moved up to number one because number one blew this or whatever. Number one moved down to number three. And then another question would be forward looking. And what would be your objectives as far as how to create buy in an ever more efficient, effective basis, and on a win-win basis, because otherwise, you know, you're going to have to start all over again with a new vendor. And if they listen to these questions and answer them and have, you know, objective answers, as opposed to, look, I buy from number one because my dad and their dad were buddies and bailed each other's businesses out long ago, and we all grew up together and have a shared buy on each other's way, you know, it's family. And so it's just total loyalty, and I'm 40, and it's my business, and I'm running it, and, you know, I'm going to buy from these guys just reflexively for the next 20 years. You know, they're not going to buy my total value proposition and rethinking how they buy in this generation. So these are questions, and you'd be surprised. We just be forthright and ask these questions. I mean, I've gone out with salespeople and said, just be honest. Say, well, you know, and the sales guy says, oh, we get the lion's share. Well, what percent is that of what? They don't know. They just ask the buyer, hey, you know, am I your number one? Oh, yeah. You tell all reps, you're the person, you know, you get the lion's share, and that they go, oh, okay, then I'm happy, I'm quiet, I'm not gonna whine and complain or whatever, I'm just gonna be happy little, you know, service assistant. So I've gone out and I've had people say, well, no, you're number three, and actually number one is number one because bump 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 bump. Oh, okay, well, if that's what they're doing, that's important to you, why don't we take that to the next level and we do this, this, this? They go, really? Oh my God, that'd be fantastic. So these are important questions to have the courage to ask. Dome selling and research, basically, you know, we really want to understand the whole business. And, you know, you'd want to walk in the back door, follow your product and the paperwork through the place, chat other people up, find out where there's pain, delays, friction, downtime, et cetera. And you kind of bottom up, wind up in the VP of supply chain saying, hey, I found a lot of, you know, weeds between the silos and here's what we could do to fix those, da, 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 da type of thing. So you could say, look, I don't know how to do your business, but I sell my stuff through a lot of people and how people buy and use and consume my stuff. I'm an expert at that. I mean, you're not bragging anyway, but basically you're sort of saying, you know, by looking at a lot of how our product flows through different businesses, you know, we have a lot of ideas to make sure that the flow through is even better, more productive, friction-free, lowest total procurement cost. So you're positioning yourself as a best practice procurement, replenishment, you know, consultant. And along the way, you're looking for direct or potential favor exchanges you can do with people who are influential. Because down the road, you may want a testimonial out of them to sort of confirm that, yes, in their little silo, they got an optimization. This is good and don't change the system. And, you know, in a stealth mode, these guys can actually give you, you know, new information or make things happen over somebody that, you know, is trying to, you know, block any kind of changes. And ideally, what you'd like to do, particularly if you've got a purchasing agent who was trying to sort of be a resistant, you know, factor, is to document enough return on investment math and make a proposal that in theory the PAA, the purchasing agent person, can't really sign up. So, wait, I can't really sign up. Well, who can? Well, my boss or my boss's boss. Well, then how do we get to them and make you look like a total hero? You know, oh, well, you know, that's an interesting idea. What would you have in mind? So we're ultimately, sooner or later, we'd like to have a summit meeting, you know, with, you know, a honcho who can see the whole elephant and get it and say, this is fantastic. And I can assure the people in the different silos that if we change things and it sub-optimizes their metric or takes away time of what they're doing, they have job security and we have new things for them to do because everybody freaks out. They don't want anything to change. And so you need somebody saying, don't worry, this is going to be good for everybody. And we'll make it work. Fourth concept, the project manager, an entrepreneurial 10. So entrepreneur is a term that suggests that you're like an entrepreneur. You can envision new things and you can make them happen over everybody who says, I don't want to change. but you're within a company. You're not out there as a solo Suzuki entrepreneur startup kind of person. Now, remember, in an earlier webinar, I talked about big buyer surveys that the Institute of Supply Management does. And I forget how much you had to buy to be a big buyer. I don't know, it was $1 million or $10 million or something. But it was always curious that for years, since, you know, well before 2000, it sort of leveled off at about 90% of the reps were like a waste of my time. The good news is, though, is that 10% were, and anybody pretty much could be a top 10% for a given target account. It's just a question of focusing and time and energy. Most people just have got their routine and they're buzzing through their territory trying to make more calls on more customers and thinking about optimizing travel time and minimizing windshield as opposed to, why don't I just camp out of this one account and crack it wide open and that would be 10 times what the rest of my territory is anyway. They're not doing that kind of math. So, you know, most reps, if they wanted to, could be a 10 for a biggest best account. It would just be a matter of a lot more research, upfront time, preparation, follow-up, so forth. So when you ask, you know, big buyers, well, who are these guys? And they go, oh, well, they've got all these different criteria. Or you could conversely say, think of all the time-wasting reps. What do they do? What are the adjectives, the attributes that make them sort of, a waste of time? And the opposite of that would start to be what makes a 10. Now, if you are a 10 and you are doing really great research and you're showing up saying, hey, you know, because I think of all my best questions on the way home in the car, I did a lot of research and I wrote them all down in advance. You give a lot of thought to how you phrase them and frame them and whatever to show, wow, this guy's got deep knowledge of my business. They're asking me stuff that I'm saying, you know, that's a really good question. I don't know, but I should know, et cetera. You're going to follow up and you're going to make me look like a hero by being my right arm and doing all this research, all that. You know, wow, that's fantastic, you know, type of thing. So, you know, if you do all those things, then the next question is, will you be able as a 10 to see and successfully seize what I call lucky portholes? Now, a lucky porthole is, you know, you're working your tail feathers off, you're patient, you're persistent, you're doing extra stuff, you're all over the place doing the things we just talked about. And it just seemed to be sort of getting nowhere. And then all of a sudden, an opportunity pops up. Because the environment is always changing, and the client always has to change to meet the environment, and new needs, problems are going to come up. And, you know, the buyer, the buying influencer say, oh, my gosh, here's a new problem. What are we going to do? And if you're vigilant and been, you know, totally honest account, you can anticipate even that some of those things will happen. And as soon as it happens, you're there to jump on it. And you've got the credibility to jump on it because you've done a deep dive. You've got trust with these people. And they say, oh, my gosh, you're right. I mean, you know, here it is. And, oh, you're going to take care of it for me right away? Awesome. Here you go. So, you know, it's going to open up because you have planted seeds or because of the environmental change. But when you go to seize it, I mean, it may take, 15 extra hours. It may take extra resources. So you may have to do whatever it takes to make sure you bag that opportunity. You get it back and you fleece it, you know, fillet it and get it in the freezer and put a padlock on it so you really own it, you know, like crazy. And, you know, in my past, I personally was involved, you know, in the 70s with, you know, basically cracking wide open Caterpillar tractor over a very recalcitrant buyer. And that took 18 months, you know, to sort of, you know, get in the door and get something going. And then it really took another 2 years before a lucky porthole opened up and I just blew it wide open. Whereas, you know, Federal Express back in 1978, you know, they started up in 1973, I think, and they went break even. You know, they were running 6 empty Falcon jets into Memphis every night, you know, losing money like crazy, hoping that there'd be enough overnight letter stuff that they'd get to break even, and then it was all pound to the bottom line. So they had just gone past break even, and a neighbor of our Memphis branch manager was tasked to create an in-plant printing shop, and we were a printing paper distributor in Memphis. And so the branch manager called and said, you know, do you know a company in FedEx? It was a fair question. I said, well, yeah, Fred Smith was in the back of my class at business school when we were doing a case study with a cloud over his head. He was, you know, bad times back in 74. And so to make a long story short, got that guy, put together a whole itinerary, you know, long story short, you know, I mean, in a week they had a total plan for what they're going to do first, second, third, fourth, equipment they needed, everything else. And we sold them 100% of the paper and they exploded. I mean, those two accounts alone made me wonder, why are we even screwing around with the other 10,000 active accounts we had over our distribution chain? So, you know, you've got to be able to seize those opportunities. Back in webinar number 4, play number 2, I talked about the CEO who went out to his biggest, best, most profitable customer and, you know, cracked it. You know, he doubled the volume and got 20% more, you know, average order size and so forth. It was a great story. Now, the question is, how does he turn around and turn that into a system? And so I'm not going to go through this stuff. So most, you know, organizations where they say, well, we actually, you know, we do have sort of key accounts, strategic accounts, you know, whatever. So we have this traditional organization where we got a honcho, we got a VP of sales, and we got branches, and maybe the branch is so big they have their own sales manager there. Maybe there's a regional sales manager who oversees the outside guys. Sometimes we have a guy who's in charge of all customer service. So we have some sort of org chart like that. In parallel, over here, when it comes to key account selling, who's the VP of key accounts? And some guys are so big they have one of these guys, as opposed to actually, I'm a one location guy with $10 million of sales, and I got 8 sales guys, and I guess I'm the VP of key accounts also. And then, you know, at the branch level, do you have sort of a designated account cracker, that entrepreneurial project manager, number 10 kind of guy? And then, you know, what kind of reports and team cooperation and so forth is special funds? Because, you know, when you go out to crack an account and you have to seize that lucky, you know, invest to sort of create the lucky porthole, and you have to have the resources to you know, seize, jump through the porthole and seize the opportunity. These things aren't necessarily in the annual budget at the branch level. It's like, oh, we don't have any money, we don't have any extra people, I'm sorry, each rep's going to just have to do what they can do, you know, type of thing. So I'm, you know, you're going to have to evolve your own thing and making sure you can sort of incorporate those five key sort of extra concepts I talked about. And I think philosophically, stepping back overall, you know, I would sort of, you know, urge you to sort of think about and promote what I call 5x5 account thinking, which just gets you more focused on the accounts that really matter, as opposed to, you know, hey, just get more business and the phone's ringing, answer the phone. And you don't realize it, but you've got reactive, the phone's ringing, you pick it up. Democratic, whoever this customer is, I'm going to take care of them. Standard, and I'm going to take care of them all the same way, as opposed to, oh my gosh, this is our number two target account. What is the question? How can I help you? Jump through hoops, make it happen, whatever. Heroic, extra energy act, the answer is yes, as opposed to, oh, the other phone's ringing, I got to get to it, type of thing. And actually, a lot of fulfillment people sort of confuse, you know, big customers who give you ridiculous activity. In other words, big losing accounts. They think those are good accounts because you see them five times every day. They're calling you up all day long, giving you small orders. And so you confuse activity with quality or profitability, which is maybe not the case. So, you know, at a given profit center, who are the five most net profitable customers? Does everybody know that by heart? Does everybody know what a heroic act is and wants to vary their service capability to really give that extra effort, creative extra effort, you know, to those people? Who are the five most unprofitable? That's a different, you know, kettle of fish as far as, hey, let's go find the friendly, open-minded guys and turn their lose-lose habits into win-win, and that creates slack, and that's great. We ask for more volume, and we win it. How do we deal with cherry pickers? These are in earlier webinars. But we can get huge leverage from turning a big loser into a big winner with 20% more volume, type of thing. So it's definitely a high leverage category to think about. Who are the five most up accounts year over year as far as operating profit, and why? And are they a gazelle? If they're a gazelle, should we start forward investing in them right now, like Newell Corporation did with Walmart back in 1988? You know, because the math of the matter makes sense in the big picture. Or like I invested that story in Caterpillar or FedEx. Who are the five most down accounts? Why? Can we still salvage it? What lessons can we learn? How do we cut down on fumbles and pass interceptions so we win the game against competition on positive turnovers? Use football, you know, terminology there. And then who are our five most likely whales to crack? Now, this 5x5 account is actually a report in the Waypoint analytics environment. You can do it at the rep level, the branch level, or the overall company. And I encourage you to go to my website. I've got two. Merrifield.com is the old one, and MerrifieldAct2.com is all my recent stuff. So if you go to that website and find Exhibit 44, it's sort of a kitchen sink. Everything you'd ever want to know about five best accounts, five biggest losers, and five target accounts, not including up and down, but they're important too. So you've got to have that kind of thinking company-wide. You know, here's a sort of a simple case of, here's a customer whale curve. A few customers make a massive amount of money. They got a lot of little losers, and they got some big accounts that lose a ton of money. Obviously, you want to turn super big losers into winners. You want to keep these guys. Where are the target accounts in this? I have no idea. I just put this up because when you look at this account, they got 13,000 customers, or no, 17,000 customers. But the bottom 81% of their customers are only giving them 4.8% of their margin, but chewing up 26.2% of their invoices, so, and 20% of their total operating expense budget. So they're losing a lot of money on these little accounts. because they have a big, cool website, and they, you know, put done search engine optimization, and they've got a zillion new accounts giving them small orders, but they don't have Amazon's cost structure, so they're actually losing money in all this business. And, you know, the reaction is, we'll change the model so somehow we can make, you know, all these little guys profit. Well, you know, the cost structure is constant. It's what the P&L is. And so if you try to shift some costs from some customers, they have to be shifted to other customers. There's no free cost to serve lunch here type of thing. But the bigger question is, what's the opportunity cost? In other words, the busyness of the bottom 81% of the customers eats up all of our intention to go after our five biggest, you know, like take these guys to the next level or turn the friendly guys here. There's a lot of friction and it's unnecessary, hidden, lose-lose activity costs. Let's clean that up. And while we're there, find more stuff to sell them. And so we turn a big loser into a big winner and then some more. And let's crank the peak internal profit much higher. Or who are the target accounts and how do we massively focus on them to blow them wide open? We can't do it because we're so busy. And most people don't think in terms of opportunity cost. So that's the key point of this slide. Summary thoughts. You know, losing minnows are instantly available. I mean, that last slide showed you, you know, a couple of their huge websites, search engine optimization. Congratulations, you doubled all your accounts in 18 months or something. Fantastic. Wow, we have more customers. But it's short-sighted, and our brain, as it evolved, is loaded with riddled with cognitive biases. And for 2 million years, there was now and not now. And so if you didn't do something right now, you were dead. Nobody really sort of had the luxury of thinking, hey, how am I going to forward invest in the long term? Because the long term was I could be dead any minute now. So that's why we love instant action and are, you know, not sort of wired or by. It's called hyper-discounting. Why we really think about long-term and what makes sense from a return on investment point of view. And also we say, well, we can't do that because, you know, reps won't like it, our incentive program militates against it, it's not in the budget, we're so busy making monthly numbers. These are all basically, I'm trapped in the now and doing what I'm doing and fine-tuning what I know, and I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. You know, it's just, it's organizational inertia. It's just everybody has it. Now what's going to happen is digital disruptors are coming along saying, hey, I'm going to offer you cream items at lower prices. And people, you know, our millennial buyers are going to check it out and web room us and give us last look. And with our cost model, we can't afford to meet it unless we get flexible and say, hey, glad you brought it up. Judo, quid pro quo. I can give you lower prices, but we have to rethink how we do business together. Let's do it on a win-win kind of basis. And a key resource, of course, is to have the entrepreneurial project manager who's sort of going to spearhead and day in, day out, work their tail feathers off to plant seeds and, you know, be vigilant for those lucky, you know, the lucky portholes and so forth, and team support to make this all happen. You know, here are all these little mice, and they're sort of coming up with an idea that, you know, the cat's killing them. So if they could put a bell on the cat, see, there's the bell. They'd hear them coming, they get to safety, and everybody gets very excited. It's a great idea. And then somebody says, yeah, but who's got the cojones to sort of go out there and put the bell on the cat? I mean, that's a little bit of a problem. So that's really what this whole webinar is about, which is that, you know that we need to crack big, progressive, open-minded, fast-growing gazelle accounts, that if we could partner them, they'd grow us. We know that. And we try to do it. So the question then is, well, how do we take that to a crystallized, better, next-level opportunity? And that's hopefully, I put some ideas out there for you to take and run with. Thank you very much.